everyone, and welcome to another episode of the No Way podcast. Okay, this week's special guest is Daniel Meslani. Daniel is best known for his work on CBC's Four in the Morning and Murdoch Mysteries, as well as YouTube's original series Impulse. He also recently starred in The Moyle, which just premiered at South by Southwest this year. He's a great friend and an even more excellent artist. Like always, you can watch this episode's No Way scenes on our Instagram page at No Way Podcast. Now, let's go to the movies. How are you, Daniel?
I'm pretty good. Yeah.
Is Lucy there? Can I say hi?
She is. She's downstairs. She is watching Raptor. So if you hear exasperation
or excitement,
there she is. Nice.
That can't be about the game, though.
That wasn't about the game. No, that was about the idea that I get to do this podcast with you three.
Daniel, do you want to give a little hello?
Hello. Here's a little hello. Hello. Here's a bigger one. Admittedly, this is our second chance because my recording stopped recording a little bit early on. So I got to do that little hello joke, which I don't think I did the first time. But the second
time... Did you think of it the first time and you were like, if I could only do this again?
No, but kind of being prepared, having heard it once before, it's like the second time around, I got really excited about that little hello joke. And I hope to bring it back.
I really appreciate how transparent you're being about, you know, what jokes you're claiming. And also, you know, that gives me a good sense that when we get into the arguments of the film, you're going to be honest about things. Look how transparent you've already been with your little hellos.
I will be transparent. I will be transparent, which is a great segue to the content of the film.
Yeah, truly. I'm just going to quickly give a little bit of a background on Daniel before we connect that pun, because I do really like it. Daniel Meslani is based in Toronto right now. I've known him since high school, I guess. We went to high school together, mm-hmm. but we're very different grades. So
very different.
Very different grades. Different
Unbelievably
numbers.
Different.
What are the most opposite grades in the world? I didn't know that they
I was
extremes.
A baby prodigy, so I was a kindergarten in grade 9, and Daniel was an old man in grade 12.
And we also had opposite grades. Like, I had straight A's, and you were failing every class.
I was a baby.
You were a prodigy that was failing every class.
But I think more connected is Daniel and I used to do a lot of improv together back in Regina. We had a bunch of different groups. For some reason, when I think of doing shows with you, I always think of a group we had called Mix Improv. And it was at a coffee shop. And Daniel and I, just the two of us, I remember once doing a show for an audience of maybe just two other people. it was like an hour long show.
And guess what? You two are at that show right now.
Yeah, exactly. Welcome, Yvonne and Mark.
Okay, hijacking the podcast just to resurrect your old improv material.
He's the guest. He gets to do what he wants.
It's true.
Can we get a location?
So, Daniel, you've brought a movie to us. Mm-hmm. Would you like to tell us what movie that is?
It is Casper. And when I was telling my mom about it today, saying I'm recording a podcast with Mike Gill about Casper, she said, "The Friendly Ghost?" And I said, "That's the one."
Hi, I'm Casper.
I forgot how much Casper was a big part of my life when I was a kid. And I think it had a huge effect on the child I became. I was really into the idea of haunted houses. I would make, this is before we were friends, Mike, but I would make kids at my birthday party walk through a haunted house that I had built. Once ending with me as a vampire that would turn around and go, "I want to suck your blood."
oh my God.
And yet I was really afraid to go into haunted houses when they were like actual real ones.
Yeah.
But I loved kind of spooky things, haunted things. I used to draw Frankenstein all the time to the point where I started thinking I had invented Frankenstein, like come up with the idea.
Just based off Casper, I was really hoping you said that at the end of your haunted house, when other kids would show up, you'd go, "Can I keep you?"
Oh my gosh. The scariest phrase there is.
It is
the
horrifying.
Scariest phrase there is.
Can I keep you?
So Casper, the Friendly Ghost, was released May 26th, 1995. It runs 100 minutes. It was written by Sherry Stoner and Deanna Oliver and was directed by Brad Silberling, and it was his debut feature film. It was produced by Steven Spielberg and released by Universal Pictures and Amblin Entertainment, so that's Steven's company. It had a budget of $50 million and grossed $288 million worldwide, so it was a pretty successful movie. It had a whole bunch of sequels after this, or prequels, in 1997, 1998, most notably with Hilary Duff, which is Casper and Wendy, and another one in 2000, which was a holiday movie for Casper. So this spurned a bit of a franchise for Universal and was super, super popular. At least it was for me as a kid. It stars Christina Ricci as Kat, Bill Pullman as Dr. Harvey, Kathy Moriarty as Kerrigan, Eric Idle as Dibbs, Malachi Pearson as Casper's voice, and then we have Devon Sawa as the real Casper, who comes in later. And he's from Vancouver, Devon. So he's
one of Canada's greatest actors, is Devon Sawa. I actually really love Devon Sawa.
I was like, I can't tell if that's genuine, but you went out of it and then you went back to being
I kind of wanted to make a joke and then I went, nah, I actually really love Devon Sawa.
I actually do love him.
It also has Joe Nipote as Stretch, Joe Alasky as Stinky, and Brad Garrett as Fatso. They're the voices.
Oh, look, it's Casper.
Stretch was huge for me.
Stretch was your guy?
Yeah.
Oh, mine was Fatso. I loved Fatso.
Yeah, mine was Fatso. Mine had to be Fatso.
You stinky Garrett. Boy, Mike?
<I'm> stinky.
So if you've never watched Casper, here's the entire movie for those people. Furious that her late father only willed her his gloomy-looking mansion rather than his millions, Kerrigan Crittenden is ready to burn the place to the ground when she discovers a map to a treasure hidden in the house. But when she enters the rickety mansion to seek her claim, she is frightened away by a wicked wave of ghosts. Determined to get her hands on his hidden fortune, she hires afterlife therapist Dr. James Harvey to exorcise the ghosts from the mansion. Harvey and his daughter Kat move in, and soon Kat meets Casper, the ghost of a young boy who's the friendliest ghost you know. But not so friendly are Casper's uncles, Stretch, Fatso, and Stinky, who are determined to drive all fleshies away. Ultimately, it is up to James and Kat to help the ghosts cross over to the other side.
Step aside, Sigmund Freud. Jump back, Joyce Brothers. It's Dr. James Harvey, therapist to the dead.
It's got a 50% tomato meter. And it got 3 stars from Roger Ebert. So it's actually quite down the middle. It wasn't well received, but it also wasn't badly received. And Roger Ebert gave it actually a pretty good review. And he said, like the Flintstones and the Addams Family, Casper is an attempt to bring cartoons to life while incorporating them with real actors and sets. As a technical achievement, it's impressive and entertaining.
There's something we like to do near the beginning of this, Daniel, which is what we kind of call the elevator pitch of sorts. And so essentially, we kind of paint the idea or the frame that you are basically asking these Hollywood execs for money to create this film. And what's your sort of quick, like 30-second-ish elevator pitch of how you explain this movie, or how you explain how to sell this movie to a group of people to get money to make your Casper the Friendly Ghost?
Yeah, like 20 seconds where it's like the essence. What is the essence of Casper?
This is a love story. This is about the timelessness of childhood hopes and dreams. And this is about the transparency of loneliness. You can float your way through life, but you can never stand on solid ground without a few helping hands. Come back to life with me this summer.
You think it was a summer release?
It was a summer release. It was a
but
summer.
But I'm pitching them to release it on VHS because they weren't going to.
They're like, this guy came in with a premise, like an emotional appeal, and he's also already figuring out the release date. Give him the money.
Yeah, I'm giving you a standing O on that one. That was that was amazing. Oh, wow.
Yo, I'm Casper. Sup, give me four.
We don't actually have a lot of givens. We discussed this before. Kayvon, if you want to kind of handle this section.
Yeah, I'll take us quickly through what we establish as givens of the universe of Casper. The big one is super obvious, ghosts. We're not here to question the existence of ghosts. And that also carries with it all the subcategories of what the ghosts in this film can do. We're not pulling apart that Casper can turn his hand into an orange pulp filter. We're not questioning that they can turn into a fried egg. We're not questioning that they have a lot of very differing abilities. So we're just taking all that and accepting that's what ghosts are like in this world. The second smaller category is we are not questioning any of the technology introduced by Casper's father, the inventor. So especially we're not going to try and question the Lazarus machine, which apparently is if you take a red Slurpee, you can bring people back if you have permission of their ghost to go in the water tank. Do you have a given that you feel should be on that list that we haven't mentioned?
I mean, I'm just looking at my notes here because, I think you covered it all. Yeah, yeah, you definitely.
Piece of cake, piece of crumb cake.
Before we go full in, I have to ask this question, everybody. Do you believe in ghosts?
I do. Like Daniel as a kid, I was super obsessed with spooky things. I loved Ghostbusters. And so I did as a kid. I believed in ghosts. And now I still do. I believe in energies. I believe in that, like, some kind of spirits or forces can imprint on a location. Do I necessarily believe in, like, a body, like, floating around? I don't think so. But I think I believe in the orb culture. And that was the big on those videos, is that they would talk about there's orbs, are these ghosts that go around. And there's like some videos you can watch of like orbs. So yeah, I believe in orbs more than ghosts.
I'm shape-based belief here. It's a bit of a shape-based issue for me.
It's like Daniel's being so polite. Yeah. And he's like, because he's never met Mario. He's like, yeah, that's really, and us having
thank
no
you.
Him, so
thank
I'm like,
you, Daniel.
Fuck off, man.
Oh, I prefer my ghost in square form.
If it ain't an orb, it ain't a ghost.
Or orb culture. Also, I love that term.
I mean, super quick, I'd say like, no, I don't believe in ghosts. I've had a few experiences where I wake up and I'm like, ghosts are real. But then as the day goes on, I'm like, that was a weird dream thing. Like, I had a ghost, I'm pretty sure, sit on my bed the other night and just, like, pet me for a second. And it was a very feminine energy. And I think it's from this picture that my roommate bought that looks very haunted. But then I was like, that was a dream. It's weird because I woke up and there
Mike,
was a bowl of water.
Mike, you're in denial. Nobody has what you just described as
I
a
felt
passing
the pressure on my
thought.
Bed.
I'm pretty sure I don't believe in ghosts. I mean, one was in the shower with me yesterday and kind of pushed me, but pretty sure it was just soap in my eye.
It's very rude to me.
I'm a hard yes. I've lived with them. I've seen them. They have spoken to me.
You say lived with them.
Yeah, the apartment I'm in right now. When I first moved in, went through quite a initial roommate process. And this old fella used to breathe in my ear when I was in bed.
Human?
And he's
this is the ghost or this is the roommate?
This is the ghost.
Oh, okay.
This is the ghost who was my roommate. No, this ghost was my roommate when I first moved in, and he used to knock things off the bathroom shelves all the time. But the worst would be I'd be in bed, and it would be like an inch away from my ear, and I would hear, and I'm 4 feet in the air, and I'm running around the room, flicking all the lights on.
Oh my God, I thought for a second he put you four feet in the air. I was like, he fucking levitated you too?
You
and you're so chill about this? All of a sudden, I'm 4 feet in the air.
The worst one ever was in this house, and I was in one room, and a buddy of mine was sleeping in the other room, and we were sharing this house. It was morning, but I was up, and I saw who I thought was Scott, moving past my door to the bathroom kind of back and forth again. And I was like, I guess he's up early. It felt early. And then I just heard Scott in the other room go, Kayvon? And I went, yeah. As soon as I heard the way he said it, I went, oh God, that wasn't right, was it? He goes, did you just walk into my room and then walk out again? I was like, nope. And he's like, you need to get in here immediately. So like I ran there and we like got under the covers like 5 year olds. And he was like, a young 17 year old boy who looked burnt just walked into this room and then walked out again. And he was like, don't call me crazy. And I said, I'm not going to call you crazy because I watched him walk past my door in the hallway too.
Kayvon, I just got goosebumps. The hair on the back of my neck is... Yeah.
It was like a burnt orb walking, floating by me.
And that was Casper. All right, let's fucking do this. Boo?
Round one. Yeah, okay, so my first No Way comes in at about 43 minutes into the film. Just to give a little context, up to this point, we've essentially just learned that these ghosts exist in a mansion. Kat and her family have moved to friendliness?
Friendship.
Friendliness or just friendly?
Friendliness.
Friendship. Friendship, main, which I think is real. Friendliness. Friendliness. This scene takes place. It's her first day at school, at her new school, and she's being introduced, and then the teacher has a bit of an announcement to make.
First, the asbestos removal from the gym is taking a little longer than planned, so we're going to have to push back the Halloween dance just by a couple of months.
We're dead for the Halloween dance, right? This girl has a seriously, seriously creepy house with room to spare.
Whipstaff?
Yeah! My No Way is that you have an entire school. We're witnessing one classroom, but we can assume, especially later on in the film, we see this is a large school. And the Halloween dance is canceled in their gym because of asbestos. And the new student basically offers to have the entire school dance at her house, which we've learned in the movie so far is a literally condemned building. The city has announced it condemned. It's haunted. Construction workers have left it. It's a dangerous place to be. Everyone knows it's scary. And not only do they accept her offer, but the teacher of this at this school brings it to a vote by the children. And when they accept this vote, or when they all say, yeah, we want to have the party at Whipstaff Manor, he goes, sounds good. And as we learn later in the movie, that's exactly how it happens. There is no way that this school would allow their Halloween dance to happen at a condemned haunted house on the offer of a brand new student they have barely
met. Okay, I totally agree.
Done. Next episode.
It's like, crazy time.
Kat doesn't suggest it at all. Doesn't she just say where she lives? And then the other kid suggests it, and then they just take a vote out of nowhere? Like, there's no... You never even see Kat agreeing dad would be... Like, there's no... She's left out of it completely, which I find even more No Way, in my opinion.
I hope this is your kind of continuous defense of the No Way. As a bit as you're like, sure, but like...
Let me talk about a different thing
for a minute here.
But I also think Daniel was right in that of like, that is part of the No Way is also that Kat, the teacher doesn't even ask of like, is this okay? Can we have the party at your house? Can I ask your father about this? Can I ask anybody? He's like just on board as the kids saying like, we're going to Whipstaff.
If we accept a given that Kat's totally peer pressured. She's in a high stress situation. She's described that this is her like 20th school. She's clearly not going to say no to any opportunity to ingratiate herself to this new student body, to new friends, hopefully, to cutie patootie with the BMX and the plaid shirt. Like, also, unrealized love story, come on. But, so she's going to go along. I think she's going to go along with it. And obviously, we've also established that Dad is feeling really guilty for having robbed Kat of her childhood for so long in the car ride. That I think that as far as the family's concerned and Kat's concerned, I see why they would go along with all of it. What I hear in Mike's No Way is that a school administration and every one of those kids' parents signed off on the condemned building house party.
Absolutely. I have a lot of issues with the logic and people's motivations, so I think I'm going to be agreeing a lot.
I'm going to offer a counter argument. It starts with a subheading, 1995, and then under that is a school that has an asbestos breakout. I just sort of getting a vibe that this is not a very well-run school. And if they've got asbestos in one part of that school, they have asbestos in the whole school. And yet they're still meeting in the classroom. Again, I'm seeing just like not a really well-run class and not a lot of responsibility being held in student safety. And you're also up to the other side of that I go back to as well, 1995. This is a bit of a different level of safety expectation going on. Yeah. And I don't know what sort of meetings might have happened. This is the conjecture argument of what kind of meetings happened between the teacher being like, fucking A, to, you know, the PTA, maybe going out to the building, having a look or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But
it would have been a great scene.
My big argument is it's 1995 and this is a school already that isn't dealing with it's dealing with asbestos. So it may not be a tight ship.
To jump on that a little bit, you know, to kind of counter argue my own no way, but just to make a point I thought of today after I was like adamant that I'm like, there's no way they'd let this dance happen. I thought of my own elementary school experience, kind of going back to what we said before about haunted places. My school in grades 7 and 8 had an outdoor education program, and they would take a bus of the kids in grades 7 and 8, and we would spend 4 nights in a condemned ex-tuberculosis hospital. It was the most haunted place in Saskatchewan, Fort Sand, and we would spend 4 nights there. And by day, we'd do activities outside, learn how to build igloos. But for most of the late afternoons through the night, we stayed there, and there were full wings that you couldn't, well, you could go in, but they were like, don't go in there because it was physically unsafe, like floors could collapse. But also, like, it was so clearly told to us, even though, like, this is a haunted building. This is where many, many people died of horrible deaths of tuberculosis. This is where we're going to take a bunch of, I guess I'd be like 12, 13-year-olds maybe, 12-year-olds, like the movie, to leave them for 4 days. So a part of me is also like, you know, there's a weird part, like, thing that maybe the school almost saw this as educational to have the dance be at Whipstaff Manor.
The other thing they talk about, though, is, like, they do make a few jokes about, like, right in that same scene, I think, that the young girl makes a joke about, oh, you mean, like, blood on your hands? Or something along those lines of that there are rumors circulating that there have been murders at this manor. And unlike the tuberculosis, so here's my no way, Mike, of, like, if I'm a parent or administration where there has been some rumored murders, people literally like run away from this place consistently, people come out with vomit on themselves.
Yeah, and recently, like recently this has happened too.
Yeah, that I just don't think with your tuberculosis place, if the school knew about all these stories of people going in and like coming out with vomit all over themselves from paranormal.
That happened once, but that's because a bunch of kids snuck alcohol in.
That I just don't see the school agreeing to this.
I find the dynamic of the popular girl a little bit more nuanced than most popular girl dynamics in most movies. Everyone hates her, but has to applaud and is subservient to her.
So I'm sure it'd be no problem having the party at my place.
Great, that's done.
Well, I think what you're pointing out, which is kind of, I've never really thought too deeply about this, but it actually is a very great little B plot about the classism that's going on in Friendship Maine. Because why she stands up and says, you can all have the party at my place, is because clearly she's a wealthy family.
Well, as most of you know, my parents have finished the new boathouse.
So, like, this is a wealthy family, and you can see that the kids are obviously, like, this is the rich family, and maybe their parents work for her parents, you know? So there's a dynamic going on there, and then classic classism being seen through in film is we want to see that rich person get theirs. So when she does get knocked off on the end and dragged out, you know, the poor people are excited that, you know, the rich girl got hers. But, you know, they didn't have to do it. They just got to witness it.
With no context, they saw them walk into the room, get horribly hurt and get dragged out and they just applauded.
Well, it maybe is that part of the way in this, in that the teacher also doesn't like this popular girl. So any alternative to her house, which they've had like nightmare stuff happen, maybe her parents are a little weird, she gets a little uptight. I don't know what's happening at their parties. But then the teacher also goes to the principal, is like, here's our options. We can go to her house or Whipstaff. Right. And they're like, let's go to Whipstaff. They're like, because
we can drink at Whipstaff. Her parents never let us there.
Because the teacher doesn't even segue to her when she puts up her hand at the beginning of class. And then she starts a sentence with, well.
Well, as most of you know.
Like, there's no now off to you.
Oh, Amber runs the school.
Right.
And I would say you're right about that. The dynamic you're describing, I think, is interesting, is that it feels like people of a lower class who don't have a choice but to laugh at the king's jokes.
Mm.
And so, the Amber seems to like be excited, and they're all like, we're excited because Amber's excited now.
Wait, I mean, I'm just going to say right now, I'm still standing by being a no way, though. I still say no way that school system let them have a dance at the
I'm with you, Mike. I'm kind of still at the no way.
I still definitely agree. There's no way.
I'm not gonna stand on stubbornness. There's no fucking way they have that dance there.
There's no way.
No way.
New kid in school, brand new kid they've never met. Everyone knows it's a haunted, destroyed building. And like, it even gets funnier when you get to the point when the dance starts. And the way it starts is they all arrive at once, teachers and students collectively in costume, and she opens the door and they just go, we're here. And it's like not one of them came early to be like, hey, where can we set up the DJ? Or like, where should we put like this thing? Or like not any preparation at all for this dance.
Oh my God. I'm loving the tone of this episode in particular, Daniel, because you seem to come with a list of your own no ways that you're like, guys.
I feel like there's part of me that wants to turn the entire show around and we three defend Casper.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
I feel like haunted stuff, ghost stuff, that was really our generation as kids. Like there were so many like scary toys and everything was really like gross, like goopy and gacky.
It was the Goosebumps kind of generation.
Stuff. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I really think Goosebumps had a major influence as being like, Goosebumps is the reason that I am a voracious reader. Like it was my gateway to literature and books. But because of that, I have a penchant for like the occult and like for spooky and for scary and Goosebumps translated into being into slasher films when I was an adolescent, where I was really in a Jason and I was really in a Nightmare on Elm Street and this sort of era. Like, yeah, there's something, you're right. There's definitely something in the Frighteners, Addams Family, Casper stuff. We got that really got popular. And also because of Tim Burton. Tim Burton became one of the leading visionary artists in that window, and his shit's all about that sort of Beetlejuice hanging trees and spooky doors, and it framed our aesthetic.
I just kind of connected that, Kayvon, too, of like, you're right that like we are the Goosebumps generation and got brought up, and I'm like, oh, is that why our generation is so What did I just
do? I just love that idea of like the way you chant this. Like it just made me picture our entire generation somewhere being like, we are the Goosebumps generation. Yeah,
let's get rid of the term millennial.
Yeah, we are the
like I want to be outside like Ottawa.
We're the bumpers.
What is our building called? Parliament, and just be like we're the Goosebumps generation.
We are from the orb culture.
Yeah.
Round two. All right, so that was a wrap it and unite it no way one. For Casper, there's no way we believe that the education system or community would permit a youth dance to happen at a condemned building with historical traumatic event. Moving forward, the dance is a go. Everyone's coming to Winthrop?
Whipstaff.
The entire school is coming to Whipstaff. What I found very interesting in this point of the film, I'm jumping us to about 50 minutes into the film for a scene and then taking us to an hour 15 minutes for the second scene. It's a two-parter to explain my no way. But it's how normalized life in that manor gets in this film. How quickly Casper and Kat have just like a household rapport. There's like a rhythm already going on in the building. The uncles seem to have normalized to hanging out with the doc and going to their appointments. It's so fast. It's one of those things that hits me when you watch films from your youth, when you get older, is you realize how short they give the time to do things and you just accept them. I recently watched Men in Black again. Will Smith had 2 days of training and he was handed the keys. It's insane. So anyways, the house is normalized and Casper and Kat are the scene we're about to watch. Casper takes Kat out of the manor on a late night journey to a lighthouse and they have an intimate scene.
What were you like when you were alive? I don't remember.
So in that scene, we saw that Casper explained to Kat that Casper has no memory of their mortal life whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And that that is a common rule for all the ghosts. Is when you die and you become a ghost, if you're a ghost, you don't cross over. You have no memories of your mortal life.
When you're a ghost, life doesn't matter that much anymore.
So now I'll take us 1 hour, 15 minutes into the film for our next scene.
My treasure!
You mean my treasure.
Miss Crittenden?
In the flesh. Well, in a couple of minutes.
So in this second scene, we see that Kerrigan has died and turned into a ghost and has returned to the basement of the manor to now be able to go through the wall of the safe, steal the money, and also be able to use the Lazarus machine to come back to her mortal flesh body and reap all the rewards and, you know, win the day. My no way is that why and how does Kerrigan retain the memories and awareness of herself and what she wants to do? She shows no hiccup from the moment she dies from over the cliff to showing up. I'll leave aside that she keeps her gown and hair, but she doesn't seem to have a hiccup between knowing who she is and what the goal was and what the intention of her purpose was, while everybody else does lose their mortal memory, including later on in the film, Dad, the doctor, when he dies, also goes clean blank. He doesn't remember Kat or where they are.
Dad?
Yeah. Hey, who's the girl?
Oh my gosh. Whoa. Yeah. Okay. So I felt like there was maybe something Casper said about it fading when you die. But I've made that up. I've maybe made that up. And it's not consistent with Bill Pullman, who's also just like fully an asshole when he sees Kat. I found that horrifying with the way that he treats her. And I'd say almost that that's a bit of a no way as well. But the sequence leading up to her becoming dead, falling off that cliff, moves so fast of them saying the idea of one of us would have to become a ghost.
If you were a ghost.
If you were.
Her swinging an axe at him. Suddenly he's in a suit of armor. Like, it just cuts. He's in a suit of armor pouring chocolate.
Is it shit? I thought it was just a bucket of shit.
And then and then it cuts again after she slipped. And he's outside now. It is so fast and so unbelievable.
The bitch is back.
But then, I'm being bad at defending the film. There is no way that she would remember according to the rules of ghosts. So, no way.
Wow.
He's conceding the second.
I think I did misunderstand the concept here, but yeah, of this podcast.
No, I find it refreshing.
I give it away. I would say okay. It does have a way possibility. And I was actually, because of something Daniel said, made me think it's a way, which is that there is proof in this film that there is a fading process to you forgetting your memories once you become a ghost. And there's proof, actually, from my understanding, that it does it, that you do remember right after you die, and then it fades. And one of those things is the fact that Casper talks about how he haunted his dad when he was a ghost, and he obviously Casper knew who he was at that time. His dad knew who he was, and so there's obviously some memory of Casper having used to remember his own life when he was still haunting his dad when his dad was alive.
I remember.
Now the thing that goes against this right now is that Bill Pullman's character, Dr. Harvey, he doesn't remember. Now here's my thought. I think he's also in the fading process like any other ghost, and the only reason he's kind of blurring all the details in that moment is because he's drunk. He's clearly a drunk ghost.
Lose it until we lose it. Come on!
Now, I realize it's a little bit of a stretch to say he's so drunk that he doesn't remember his own daughter, but A, yes, and B, it's like, I think the combination of being that hammered and then dying, I think he is in a little bit of a really messed up state.
Is there something to be said in the state that you die in this world affects and informs the way you immediately come back as a ghost? Because that's what I was thinking, Mike, of like, if you die drunk, you're going to wake up with a lot, with a fuzzy,
we learned that, like,
memory.
Clearly you're in the same sort of state you were when you die. I wonder actually if Dr. Harvey's ghost would have been drunk for all eternity, because that's
well, he would have been drunky. It would have been fatso, stretch, stinky, and drunky.
Oh my gosh, drunky is very similar to a series of pirates that I used to draw when I was a kid, but his name is Drunker. There was Mathematicianer, Drunker. They all had and it was totally based on Stinky and Fatso, for sure. And Stretch.
Yeah, the tough thing, too, is we're learning it through, like, I don't want to use the term unreliable narrator, but he is a 12-year-old. Like, we're learning about the process of death and haunting and turning into a ghost from the perspective of a 12-year-old. And, like,
why does he have no features? Why do Fatso, Stretch, and Stinky have no features, and yet Bill Pullman and Kerrigan?
I have a counter argument. That's a fading process.
You forget who you are,
Kerrigan and Doc show up, and they're the most recent ghosts we have, and they still have like the clothes they had on, and they have hair. But the other ones who have been here a long time have sort of melted to this sort of amorphous ghost shape.
That also explains Kayvon, because we are assuming, and well, it's confirmed that this is the same universe as Ghostbusters.
Who are you gonna call? Someone else.
So I always wondered why Slimer, the little...
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah.
So I'm like, who is he when he was a person? And that just explained why, to me, he is a little gremlin goblin, because he's faded and forgotten his human form over what could be thousands of years. And now
while we're on that sequence where Ghostbusters are revealed to be part of this universe, I just want to... Was it The Exorcist or one guy who went in who described getting it done as piece of cake, piece of crumb cake?
Piece of crumb cake.
I'm going to say that.
Where are we standing on this one?
I forgot what the no way was.
It's that Kerrigan came back with full memories of being of her life.
Marky, and I feel like you haven't really the rules. Get in here.
If Kerrigan came back as an orb, I would have been way on this one.
Of course.
But she didn't. She came back as a fully formed Kerrigan version of herself. And I've listened to all the arguments here. I've tried to maybe massage a way in here, but it's just like none of us could offer anything to weigh this one. It just kind of stays in no way for me. It doesn't make any sense.
Not so fast, little man.
I'm going to offer the way on my own no way. It lives in tandem with what I already said, which is that their physical features fade as they leave humanity. As the further they grow apart from their mortal days and further step into their ghost world, the physical features fade as well. That's how we've explained that away. So then thereby, should their physical memories also fade, our counter argument to that is that the doctor... He seems to not remember anything, but you're right, Mike. He died drunk in a traumatic falling experience, drunk. And he would have stayed riled up by the trio of uncles the whole time as he got there.
Catatonic, catastrophic,
Greplock soup.
But Casper did say that you forget everything.
It's as far as that 12-year-old boy concerned.
He's a 12. You think he's a... He died... How long ago did he die, too? Like 100 years? He doesn't remember the event. Here's a really great question.
Ask an amnesiac at the exact moment they forgot everything.
Whoa.
Flash flood alert.
It's like falling asleep. Whoa. You never remember when he fell asleep.
Oh, yeah.
So the argument here being that when you die, you actually do remember. And... you are in a state of your unfinished business is very clear to you. You know, you're pretty lucid as a ghost. And over time, that starts fading away. And Casper just doesn't remember because, you know, he has just forgotten. So therefore,
It's been so long.
He doesn't even remember.
Well, we do have evidence that Casper did know about his mortal life as a ghost, because otherwise he wouldn't know what the Lazarus machine was. Mm. The only way he would know what the machine is and how it works is if he was sentient of his mortal life as a ghost until his dad died.
McFadden claimed that he was haunted by the ghost of his dead son and that he invented a machine to bring him back to life. The Lazarus.
For me, where that lives is that we've established that Casper's dad was alive while Casper was a ghost.
Yes.
Therefore, like Dr. Harvey here, needs to just be reminded, and you have the ability to be reminded. So if Casper shows up as a ghost, his dad is like, "You're my son. Remember the pinky thing?" And then it's like, oh, it all comes back. Just like we see with Kat and Dr. Harvey. So I don't think it's a stretch to say that as a ghost you can be... I don't think it's a stinky to say that you can be reminded of things as a ghost of like, oh yeah, I was this person as a ghost.
I had 5 fingers.
I've actually walked my way out of a no way.
Yeah, I'm just going to jump in very quickly. It's a way. I think it is a way based off exactly what you said. And I just stand by the fact that, we only have 2 examples in the film of seeing someone die and become a ghost in that moment. And they both kind of follow the same rules a little bit, except for the fact that, like, Dr. Harvey is hammered and he didn't plan to die. It wasn't on his list of things to do that day, unlike kind of with Kerrigan a little bit. I think it's a way.
I'm amazed, Kayvon, that you turned this around. We were just talking 5 minutes ago about how this is impossible, and now you have actually swayed me in the other direction based on your own critique of your own no way. Because, okay, that stuff all makes sense to me that we just talked about, of why the physical manifestation and everything you've just said actually makes sense to me. So I've come around, and I'm on the way train now.
Oh, my gosh. This is a piece of crumb cake for me. I'm going to say it's a way.
Life finds a way.
It is a way. You're right. I believe it. The fading process is real. And the fading process is something I think we've all experienced in this year of staying indoors and isolation and forgetting what our unfinished business was from last March.
It's fade culture.
Oh my god. Fade culture, orb culture with the goosebump generation.
Hey Fatso, you smell something?
Yeah.
No, besides him.
Is there another no way coming up?
Yeah, Markian, take us home. It's we're 1-1. Round 1 led by Mike was a no way. Round 2 led by me was a way, which I self-destructed. All right, Markian, take us home with our last round.
Round 3.
Well, mine is kind of the creme de la creme of the movie and in our no ways, because I think it opens up a larger conversation of Casper, the character, going forward, even existing after this movie. And it comes right at the end of the movie. My no way is right at the end of the movie. We've had the dance. Casper has come back. He's been given apparently about 5 to 10 minutes to be alive till 10 o'clock p.m. to be a real boy again, which we have learned that was his unfinished business. He wants to be a boy again. And so let's watch it. It comes right at the end of the movie, right after the dance, and he is in fact being now turned back to being Casper in the ghost form.
Not bad for my first party, huh? Couldn't have been better.
It ain't over yet.
Boys?
It ain't over yet, boys.
So there we go. You kind of get the gist. My No Way, we've established that ghosts have unfinished business, and that is their reason for being a ghost in the first place. To me, if Casper's, which I think is his unfinished business, is having a boy flesh experience, falling in love, maybe
it's unfinished business.
We are now sponsored by Nambla.
Wait, what I said?
His unfinished business is to have a boy flesh experience.
You're so naive. It's cute, but it's horrifying what you said.
Oh my. All right.
I love the smell of fleshies in the morning.
He's got a Pinocchio problem and how he wants to be a real boy.
Yes.
Because he died young. He was given that opportunity in this moment here. Why doesn't he cross over? To me, Casper should be crossovered, and there's no way he would revert back to being mm-hmm. Casper in this moment.
Well, wow. Because I never saw it in the context, I guess, of this being his unfinished business. I'm not. Does the angel say it? Does the? I thought it was his greatest wish.
And for what you've done, I'm giving you your dream in return.
Is that not your unfinished business?
Yeah. I think it was his greatest wish. You can't have your unfinished business as a kid. Like, it's like, I feel like that was more his ghost wish than his childhood wish.
What we need to have a consensus then, I think, on what we think Casper's unfinished business is, to then decide whether or not we think that this film achieved that unfinished business. One of the ones that I'll offer, which is the most spoken of in the film, is to have a friend.
So if I can also just butt in here, I've been talking a lot, obviously, because it's my No Way. But yes, I agree, Kayvon. It's to have a friend, which he, again, achieves in spades. But also, why did he bring this girl here to the first place? Yes, to have a friend. And he saw her on TV and was like, maybe I will obviously love this girl, but there's something else she can do. What can she do? I can convince her and make her fall in love with me in order to bring me back from the dead, because that's my ultimate, that's my, super goal of this entire movie is...
Well, he doesn't know that yet.
But he brings her downstairs. Is like, this is how
he doesn't remember until she finds the toy room.
But did he say he wanted a friend even as a kid? Like, I thought he was content as a kid. But he just wants a friend now.
We don't know.
As a ghost.
We don't know what the unfinished business as a kid was to get that fucking sled. He got that shit, so he should have moved on.
I begged and begged my dad to get me this sled.
I think his ghost wish is just to have a friend because he's scaring everyone.
Yeah, yeah, I'm kind of with you here, Daniel, because we do witness a crossover in the film. Kerrigan has a crossover. They trick her into experiencing one because her living wish, I forget the exact words, but was something like she wants to have treasure, she wants to have all the money in the world, she wants wealth. And they get her as a ghost to say, like, I've got everything I've ever wanted now, I've got my wealth, and then she starts to cross over because her living unfinished business is resolved. So I'm not quite a No Way or a Way on this one yet. I'm just trying to figure it out. But it's like, yeah, what we're witnessing at the end of the movie is Casper's ghost form getting their wish. But is corporeal the right term here for a physical form? His corporeal form?
Mm-hmm.
His corporeal form. Flesh. My roommate really wanted me to use the term corporeal form as much as I could. So his corporeal form, we don't know really what Casper's...
Are you getting side coachings on this podcast, Mike? Because if you're getting side coachings for words...
he's just Mark right there. Max been there the whole time writing notes.
Yeah.
No, but I think Daniel's onto something.
Corporeal.
Could say corporeal. But I think Daniel's onto something. We don't know what Casper's physical form, his living form's unrealized wish was, or you know, yeah.
What could it possibly be as a 7-year-old to 12-year-old
To catch a baseball at a game or something? Like, I think it has to do with that, or trains or something.
A ball? That's your treasure? Are you kidding? It's autographed by Duke Snyder, the Brooklyn Dodgers.
So this is getting very religious, and not religious, but like philosophical in its way, is that we're saying that his corporeal forms, life,
great word,
and mandates are separate to his soul, his energy's new identity. That the Casper the ghost is almost an entirely different person than Casper the person, which is also accurately represented in the film by letting Devon Sawa be the corporeal form and letting Malachi just be the voice of the ghost. So is that they're so separate and they're so pulled apart now that Casper's unfinished business is not related to the identity of Casper as a ghost.
Yeah, because of time. I think because of time. And that's why with Kerrigan, it's like right away, that's all she really cares about. She remembers that right away. But you know, with time, I think as they fade away, it also faded away whatever his unresolved wish was, probably. Which is quite tragic.
Markian, what do you think Casper's unfinished business is?
If I'm putting myself in Casper's shoes...
He doesn't have feet,
Markian. He doesn't have legs. He
doesn't have shoes.
If I'm putting him in his larger orb manifestation, it would be my ultimate wish would be to be alive again. And I know this is from a film standpoint as well, too. I just think that him crossing over and being at peace and thanking Kat for coming and doing what she did to let him cross over, and him remembering that this was what he wanted all along and got to crossover, would have been such a good ending to this film.
A satisfying standalone film story is that after that kiss, instead of him just turning invisible and going boo, we see that beautiful white crossing over light, and there's this moment of like, he got to finish his business and be with his dad.
It's tricky. Like, from everything we're taught in this film, I feel like, and based off just how simple other people's unresolved issues were, like Kerrigan's unresolved thing was so simple at the end of the day. It was just she wanted wealth. So the fact that I'm kind of saying it's a bit of a no way, because it feels like Casper's is probably even simpler being a 12-year-old. And it was probably something as simple as, yeah, I want a friend, or I want to have a first kiss, or something like that. And he got those. He got everything that we were told he wanted in this film. So I'm surprised that he didn't also cross over.
When Casper regains all of his mortal memories by going to the kids' toy room,
Hootie!
And seeing the sled and remembering his dad and remembering his life, remember being on the how he got like sick and then he died, and then he remembers the Lazarus room. He remembers everything. And that his dad died before he could help him finish the process. Why in that moment, then, would he not have full recollection of his unfinished business as well? If we talk about the separation of the ghost Casper to the corporeal Casper, I've yanked your word and I'm going to edit it so it sounds like I only said it.
No,
Is if we've shown that they've merged his physical life and his spiritual life have come back together in that moment, then when the angel mom visits him, she is speaking to a unified experience. And when she says one wish, she is talking to both sides of that life.
I would say, though, that when Kerrigan gets the money, her wish is to be rich as a human who's alive. And so them telling her, you got your wish, and you got your unfinished business. She's got money, but she can't do anything as a ghost until she becomes human. So technically, she would have to become human, and then she would have to die, or she'd have to ascend.
Yeah. And then she'd cross over. What an interesting fate that would be.
I think,
but you can't cross over as a human.
If your unfinished business is dependent on you being human, then you will never get it as a ghost.
But he did it.
Exactly.
But he did
got the opportunity to be human.
He got to become Devon Sawa. He got to go down to the dance. He got to dance with his friend. He got to kiss.
But the premise of having unfinished business is it's almost like this section that is given to ghosts so that they can then learn something and go on to an afterlife. And I feel like the rules wouldn't be like you are like stuck in a technicality, like a catch-22, and you can never get to the second level. Like it feels like it's a period that should be able to be solved within your rules of existence. Because that's why you're a ghost. Mm. You're not a ghost to become a human.
Yeah, actually, that's right. That's right. Because, yeah, if the only way you could solve your unfinished business was to become human to do something, that doesn't make any sense, because that would mean that, like, the whole whoever's creating the rules of ghosts is also then going, like, and you need to get to a Lazarus machine.
Right.
That's
it's
part
a catch
of
20. It's a catch-22, exactly. And it's very cruel.
Is there anything in that Casper doesn't want to cross over then?
Maybe, well, because the uncles don't, and he just wants a friend, and I don't know that he will find that in the same way in the afterlife, but I can't say that.
So if the wish of being able to go to the party and dance with Kat, and I'm sure Mom didn't agree to the kiss, but get the smooch, you know, if that was all just a little, like, treat,
yeah,
because Casper sacrificed the Lazarus machine to the dad, it was a very noble moment where Casper said, no, your dad needs this more than I do. Is this all because Casper's kind of cool being a ghost in this house as long as Kat's there?
Would Casper not also want to go to the afterlife to be with his dad and family? And
I mean, he's a
12-year-old
boy and there's a pretty girl in his bed. I mean,
he even mentions that. He's like, there's a girl in my bed. Just weird.
Yeah, I mean, a 12-year-old boy's probably going to give up heaven for the cat who's in his bed.
There's a girl on my bed. Yes.
We have an example of a ghost crossing over because their unfinished business from their corporeal form's life happens while they're a ghost. And that checks out to me. Checks out why Kerrigan crosses over to me. Casper doesn't. And I think that's because the things that happen, the greatest wish, and I think Kat's mom is even speaking to Casper as a ghost. I mean, he's been a ghost for like what I think is like a long time. So I think he's got his own new wants and needs and unresolved businesses as a ghost now, which have no reflection on the ones he had as a person. And I think that night, Kat's mom is speaking to Casper as Casper the friendly ghost and the things he wants as a ghost more than she's granting the wish of Casper the sledding, baseball playing, dying of pneumonia boy. I think that he doesn't cross over because his unresolved business has not happened yet. We don't know what that is per se. We have some hints, but the movie has no interest in telling us it. Anything past that's conjecture. I think it's a way that he doesn't pass over.
I'm going to jump on with Mike. I think it's a way. I think that we don't have enough information to know what the unfinished business was. So I go away. I think it's lazy that they didn't talk about it. Nobody asked Casper what his unfinished business was, but it just didn't come up.
Daniel, what's your verdict on this last point here?
I think.
Life finds a way.
Fine. I'm still in no way on it.
Fine.
Fine. I'm still in no way. But now we've come to the end of this podcast where we have now had 2 out of 3 our ways. So by our rules, this movie is a way.
Piece of cake. Piece of crumb cake.
Yes.
There it is.
You brought away. Casper's away.
And the last part of our podcast here is asking the funometer, do we love this film and how much did we enjoy it?
Out of 100? Is that out of 100?
Yes, out of 100. So a score, kind of like a tomato meter type thing, but ours is called a funometer. It's different. I guess I'll start it off. I'm at about a 70% on this one.
Oh.
Watching it back, I did love Casper growing up, but it's oddly just not one of those movies that I am just super attached to now for some reason. There's a lot of other movies that I just have a much bigger nostalgic factor out of it. And this one isn't one of them.
Yeah, I'd give it a 77.5. I don't want to give it a 75. I don't want to quite give it an 80. I watched this movie quite a bit growing up. I do recall that. And I still, to this day, love the aesthetic of the whole thing. Mm. I love the design elements. I actually find that the way they did the ghosts still kind of stands up in terms of like a technical CGI way, because they did it in such a specific choice. Yeah, so I had a lot of fun with it. But at the same time, I'm with you where it's like watching it again, I go, that's not quite there's moments where I fell out of enjoying it. Also, I think just because of how much of a little pervert Casper is. There's a couple of times I was like, you're making me uncomfortable, Casper. You can't whisper, "Can I keep you?" anymore. You don't get to keep people. That's not what you get to do, bud. So, 77.5.
96.
Oh, my man.
I love this movie. I chuckled and laughed my way through it. Again, I still find it really funny. I just really had a really great time. And it brings me back to a very innocent place in my life. And yeah, I'm a full 96 still.
Wow. Yes, aesthetically, I think it's really strong. I think the transparent ghosts, when they go like full invisible, but you can still see the outline, is really beautiful. That fish face that's like the newel post at the top of the stairs. When I saw that fish face, I was like brought back to childhood, which is the nostalgic factor is one thing for sure. But very fun, really good performances. Bill Pullman's amazing. And I would give it an 80.
Nice. Daniel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is so fantastic. It was so great to see you. I know you as such an imaginative, creative person, and I was really excited to have you in this podcast for that reason.
Oh.
And it's been fun to see that side, and it's also been such a fun surprise to kind of see you also just be completely like, no, I agree, done. I'm not pushing it. I'm not going to conjecture it. I agree with you. You know, you've expressed two sides really lovely in a really lovely way.
Well, I'm excited to hear more of the podcast. It was super fun. I really like the premise. And
I feel like there's so many things we said in this that we could leave as the catch line. At the end of it, we could say we're the Goosebumps generation. We could mention something about
orb culture.
All right, it was a pleasure. It was a pleasure meeting you, too. Daniel.
Yeah, and thanks, Daniel.
Thanks for hanging out with us and bringing this great movie from all our lives to the show, and letting us talk about ghosts.
So much fun.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the No Way Podcast. No Way is produced by Markian Tarasiak, Kayvon Koshkam, and Mike Gill with the help of Speakeasy Theater and the Cinematics Creation Company. The show is edited by Kayvon Koshkam and mastered by Malcolm Dow with original music by Ben Elliott. The No Way Podcast is produced on the unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. Please join us next Friday for another exciting episode of No Way, and make sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at No Way Podcast and Twitter at No Way Pod. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time at the movies.